Here's an oldie, girls and boys. Have you ever read Don DeLillo's novel, White Noise? There's a drug with a side effect, spoiler alert, if someone merely says, hail of bullets, people hit the dirt. Because mere words are perceived as real things. The novel's from 1985. As for the side effect, nowadays, that's what the stock market brings.
And scene.
Hear ye, all ye who hear this here podcast, know this. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing discussed on this podcast should be considered investment advice. The hosts hold no licenses and are not financial advisors. Do your own research before making investment decisions, and we do hope you enjoy this podcast.
All right, we're ready.
Ben Hunt, welcome to TC's Charcast. So great that you could join us.
It's great to be here, man. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
No, it's a thrill for us. We're huge fans of your work and been listening to you on the Grant Williams podcast, The Narrative, and you guys have been great. And we've long hoped that you would come on the show, and we couldn't be more thrilled. You have a really amazing and diverse background and bio. Why don't you begin, as we always do, by telling the audience who Ben Hunt is and sketch the arc of your really amazing career.
Well, diverse is certainly true. The amazing part, I don't know. I still wonder what I'm going to be when I grow up. That kind of sums it up. I've done a lot of different things, and everything has been more of a way station or a path than a destination. I got a PhD in political science, of all oxymorons, and had an academic career. I was a professor, a tenured professor, and taught for about 10 years. And I loved it. I loved the research part of it. I loved the teaching part of it. The church-like aspects of academia are, more than a little problematic. If you've got that entrepreneurial bug, and it is a bug, right? It's not a feature, it's a bug. So I started a couple of companies while I was in academia. I was just a self-taught programmer. I think like so many founders and entrepreneurs are, but ultimately ended up leaving the church. So I'm now a defrocked academic to go and start a software company. And we started the software company in March of 2000. The day the NASDAQ bubble burst, which somehow and sometimes seems relevant to today. But we did all right with the software company because we had a very niche product. But it gets boring after a while. I got to say, that's again the notion of way station rather than an endpoint. So I sold the software company. I had enjoyed the game of investing, private investing around the software company, and so I did that for a couple of years. And along the way, for that, discovered the biggest game in the world, which is the game of public equity investing. So a buddy of mine was the head of research at an asset manager. We were always talking about the game of markets, and joined up with his firm to start an in-house hedge fund, a long short equity fund. And that was my baptism by fire with public equities and public equity investing. We have some life experiences and other experiences that I think give us an aptitude for our new thing. But it's something that we start off as a new thing. It is a baptism by fire. And there are certain points in time in the history of the world where doing something new and having that sort of different outlook makes a difference where it works. There are plenty of other points of time in history where having that sort of different outlook and different background doesn't help you out. But I think certainly over the last, the last 20 years, let's say, it's been an advantage for having that outsider's perspective. That outsider's perspective happened to be the right thing at the right time, starting a hedge fund in 05 and running that through 2012. And having that outsider perspective allowed us to do really well, particularly in the, 08, 09. But from 09 forward, it's like you went to the wall and you just flipped a switch on our hedge fund returns. They just flatlined. And, we never lost money for clients, which is something that I'm still really proud of. But by 2012, it was clear that even with an outsider's perspective, our way of thinking about markets and investing, thinking about cash flows and fundamentals and catalysts on a corporate basis and the like, that just didn't work anymore. So it was the hardest thing we ever did. And I, tell this before, I don't think my wife really has still forgiven me, but we gave back all the money in the hedge fund to our investors. And, it wasn't a small amount of money. It was close to $1 billion. But it's not just that it wasn't intellectually honest. It was clear that if I was going to understand how do you make money in markets today, what's driving markets? And frankly, my old field of political science, what's driving politics today? It really required a reset and rethinking about what was important and how it worked. So it was the summer of 2013 when I started writing Epsilon Theory, where it was really a public exercise in not self-flagellation, but trying to figure this stuff out, an acknowledgement that I think I know the path to look, which is to look at narratives and the way that the unstructured data, the way that communications impact our decision making in a very regular way, in a way that's augmented and by social media and other technological developments, but more than that, augmented by the way our institutions have developed. Particularly around central banks, other really institutions that exist at that intersection of politics and markets. Also, the way that corporate management has changed. And I know we'll get to this when we talk about Elon, but his great skill is being that, what we call in game theory, that missionary, someone who is able to create a narrative despite no reality to back it up, but is able to create those narratives that have certainly allowed him to create great wealth for himself, but more broadly have allowed political and economic missionaries to create a political and economic system today that is disconnected from the real world. And my view, almost totally driven by these questions of narrative and the stories we can create. So, started writing about that in 2013. Yeah, just trying to figure out, how to make your way in the world and not doing anything other than that. And I sent these notes out that my first one was so grandiose, right? I called it a manifesto. I mean, how self-absorbed is that, right? That you write a note and you call it a manifesto. And I sent it out to about 100 friends and colleagues. And the weirdest thing has happened, right? And it's like that old police song where, you toss the message in a bottle, right? You toss the bottle into the ocean. And then, wake up the next morning and 1,000 bottles have washed up on your shore. And that's really been the experience with Epsilon Theory. We've never marketed it or, done any advertising. It's all just been through word of mouth. And I think I write pretty well, but I don't think it's that so much as it is the shared notion by so many of us out in the world that we are living in a world where reality has been disconnected from the narrative creation of powerful people and powerful institutions who do this for their own aggrandizement. So from that, you know, 100 bottles that I tossed out, you know, we've got over 100,000 now subscribers and readers for Epsilon Theory. And that's become this most gratifying thing to me personally, but also the thing that gives me hope for the world out there. Like me, I think this describes you and a lot of listeners who are pulling your hair out over the mendacity that we are immersed in on a day-to-day basis, right? The feelings you're having, you're not alone. You're not alone. And that, again, to me, is just this most sustaining emotion to know that we're not alone, that we are, there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of us truth seekers out there, young, old, men, women, you know, English speaking, non-English speaking, it doesn't matter. We're out there. And it's, again, this is part of what I admire what you do, TC. It's the creation of what I'll call these epistemic communities, communities of thought, where we stitch ourselves together and we understand that we're not alone. So that's a crazy long-winded answer to your very basic question, but it really describes who I am and why I think it's so important to find this community, to stitch people together who are trying to look for truth, who are dissatisfied with this chasm that exists between the way we're told the world exists and the way we see with our own eyes the way the world exists. That's what I'm all about. That's why I'm so glad to be here today.
Yeah, no, as you talk, one of the things we're very interested in understanding is just sort of how you've built this Epsilon Theory from that, you know, 100-person email. And and over time, and we have a lot of listeners, you know, as George and I have built this podcast together and thinking about sort of how do you sort of convert that audience into something that you can do for a living. We have many listeners that write newsletters and we have many guests that have written newsletters.
Yep.
Very curious to get your thoughts on that side of the business. You know, you went from being a professor to managing money to now basically doing the Epsilon Theory for a living. Talk to us a little bit about the model, how it works, and any thoughts or advice you might have on people aspiring to replicate your success.
Yeah, you bet. So the advice I've got is the only currency that's worth anything today is authenticity. It's having a voice and then staying true to that voice. So there will be plenty of opportunities and temptations to squelch that voice, to mold that voice in service to whoever's going to help you pay the bills. And my biggest piece of advice is don't do it, because readers, listeners, viewers, you can smell inauthenticity. You can smell that squelching of a voice from 100 miles away. I mean, it reeks. It reeks. And that's how you lose listeners or readers. And conversely, the way you gain people, the way you gain readers and listeners, you gain an audience, is through maintaining that voice and the authenticity of your voice. It's also showing up for work every day. Right? It's I can't tell you how many, I guess I could tell you. I mean it's like a dozen guest authors, guest posters that we've had on Epsilon Theory. And these are people who are really smart and intelligent, and they write so well, and it's wonderful. And they always start off with a vision that, all right, I'm gonna publish this every, you know, 2 weeks. I'm gonna, you know, boy, that this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to build my quote unquote brand or audience because I've really got a lot to say. And without exception, that dedication to the craft of writing or speaking or doing podcasts, it'll last for a couple of months, you know, maybe even 4 or 5 months. And then the 2 weeks becomes 3 weeks, becomes 4 weeks, becomes never. The hardest part about this business, and I know this is true, or I suspect this is true from conversations I've had with people in other forms of communication, right? Whether it's show business or anything, is you got to show up for work every day. And if you don't feel a compulsion to write, to put on a podcast, to do whatever it is, the way that you express your voice, if you're doing it as a means to an end rather than an end in itself, don't start. But please, just don't start. You may be a beautiful artist. You may have a beautiful voice, right? Whether that's writing or performing or whatever it is that you do with your voice. But if it's not a compulsion for you, if it's not something that you can't help yourself but do all the time, that consumes every waking moment. And if you have this compulsion, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't have that compulsion, you have no idea what I'm talking about. If you don't have that compulsion, don't go down this road, because you won't be able to stick with it. You won't be able to maintain that authenticity that is the sine qua non for making a business success out of this. So, yeah, another long-winded response, but you're right. It is such an important question, because we've all got something to say. We've all got something to say. And I think that convert that into a business, though, is really tough. And it requires that degree of compulsion. It requires that willingness not to compromise. If you've got those two attributes, then I think you can make it work. But if you don't, it's just going to end in tears, I promise.
Ben, talk to us a little bit about your impressions of academia and higher learning as it stands today. You spent some time in academia. You've highlighted that you were a tenured professor, so I assume that's a meaningful designation to you. And you spend so much time thinking about narrative as it relates to the culture in this country. And oftentimes we can think about academia and higher learning perhaps having a role in that culture and in that narrative developing as well. So be very interested in your thoughts on the state of academia and what you think the future holds for higher learning.
You know, I'll separate, I think, the institutionalization of higher learning, the, as I like to call it, the, you know, I'd like to write about the financialization of markets, right, of politics, but you can also talk about the financialization of different, or any different area of human activity, right? You can talk about the financializations of law firms, the financialization of medicine. You can absolutely talk about the financialization of higher education as an institution. So I want to come back to that. But first, what I want to say about that social practice of higher education, of academia, it's magic. I think it is a thing, a social practice that is responsible for so much good in the world, both on the technology side, both on how we advance as a species and a culture. It's amazing. And the most amazing thing part about it, and the reason why I loved my time in academia, is that nobody tells you what you're going to work on. Nobody tells you what questions are important to you. Academia is the place where you build your intellectual capital. That can be as an undergraduate, it can be as a graduate student, it can be as a professor. While you are an academic, you are building your intellectual capital. And that's an amazing thing, right? It's so hard to build our intellectual capital once we get outside of college, whether we're there as a student or we're there as a professional, as a graduate student or as a professor. You're always building your intellectual capital. It attracts the people who don't want to be told what it is they need to think about and how they need to think and what questions they need to ask. So that aspect, I'll call it the non-institutionalized aspect of academia, it's magic. It is such a powerful force for good in this world, in this country, and wherever you have an institution of higher learning. The problem, of course, and this is the problem with every institution we have, again, whether it's, you know, corporations or markets in general, or political parties or politics in general, or, you know, again, anything you want to mention, law firms, medical school, academia, is this financialization. Right? It's the way that the making of money and the requirements of scale and leverage and what it requires to make money has succeeded in warping all of these institutions that I just mentioned, and academia is certainly one of them. So it is a church, and you know, just like the church in the Middle Ages, it becomes a vehicle for worldly, i.e., economic advancement and maintenance of that status quo, as opposed to again being this vibrant seedbed for the smartest people in the world looking at questions they think are interesting and just going off and working on it. So, you know, those are my conflicting views around academia. Those, I think, represent my conflicting views about so many things that institutions that exist in our world today. Unfortunately, I think that all these institutions, these social practices, and academia is one of them, they're in a very stable equilibrium state. Right? And what I mean by that is the way the rules of the game are currently set up, they're never going to change through incremental adjustment. They're never going to change by, you know, switching out one person versus another person, because the incentives, the rules of the game are set up to leave you in this equilibrium. And that's what an equilibrium means. It means that none of the parties have any incentive, any self-interest in moving away from that position. The only way to change an institution or a embedded social practice once it reaches these really strong, stable equilibrium points, hey, you got to burn it down, or as I like to call it, you know, BITFD. You've got to burn it the fuck down. And that's true for the system of higher education. That's true for our system of politics. That's true for our system of public markets and investing. It becomes so daunting because we've created this very stable world where narrative, opinions presented as fact, are augmented by our technologies so that they leave us in these equilibrium states that, you know, the narrative says, oh, this is the best of all possible worlds, but we see with our own eyes that it's not. And, you know, again, one more really long-winded answer to a pretty simple question, but, you know, free markets, academia, you know, representative government, these are all really good things, but they've all been financialized, they've all been bastardized by our very effective way of nudging, of using narrative to get us to say, huh, yeah, that's the way it's got to be, right? And it doesn't. But that's where we are. And unfortunately, I think that's where we are with almost everything in modern society.
You know, my own experience with academia and George's is pretty similar, I think, is despite proclaiming to be sort of these bastions of forward thinking and enlightenment, they tend to be some of the most backward institutions on the planet, especially as it pertains to sort of diversity of thought and inclusion. And it's very ironic, but, you know, this isn't a show about all that necessarily. I would say, though, that academia as a business model is on the verge of collapse, I think. And I think COVID is the sort of kind of stress to an equilibrium situation that might bring the thermodynamic situation to bear. You've referenced narrative a lot in your answer. Narrative is a key thread of epsilon theory in your writing. Why don't you sort of take a step back, tell the audience what you mean when you say narrative, and then maybe give one or two, you know, high profile examples of what you've written about, where the power of narrative to do good and in many cases bad is laid bare.
Look, I think we all kind of know instinctively what narrative is, right? Narrative is a story. And what I think is maybe less notable or noticeable is the degree to which story permeates everything we do as the human animal. And it's interesting, at least interesting to me, the degree to which our responsiveness to story and to what I'll call as unstructured data, intraspecies, you know, human to human, unstructured data communications, the degree to which we swim in this ocean. So there's a you know, a wonderful series of books by the biologist, or you might even call him a social biologist, E.O. Wilson, Edward Wilson. And his study, he was a biologist, and his field was ants. I mean, he's wrote this amazing book about ants. And ants are what are known as a eusocial species, EU social species. That's the word. And it turns out that most of the most successful species on Earth, certainly the three most successful species on Earth, ants, bees, and termites, they're all these eusocial creatures. Well, there are very few other technically eusocial species on Earth, and one of them happens to be the fourth most successful animal species on the planet, human beings. Now, the hallmarks of eusociality, you know, there's kind of a laundry list of what it requires, of what these species, these four most successful species on Earth, what they share. Things like, you know, different generations share caregiving for the brood, the young, that they have a stable nest. You know, there's a list of things, but the most important of them is that these species, without exception, they are hardwired to respond to these intraspecies communications, that they swim in it, that they are immersed in it day to day. Now, you literally swim in it if you are a bee, an ant, or a termite, right? Because the communication is obviously not through words or sound, it's through pheromones, through chemicals that are emitted in the air. Humans, you know, I guess we've still got pheromones, but they're not so impactful for us. For us, it's our verbal communications. And what I would say is that we are no more immune to the words of, you know, a Fed chair than an ant is immune to the pheromones of its queen. Now, you know, we've got more advanced brains, or bigger brains at least, right? So we do have at least the ability to create consciousness and a distance between ourselves and our actions and those messages that we see. And we have opposable thumbs, and we're big enough that we can control fire. But that's basically it. I mean, basically, human beings are giant termites with fire, and our hardwired nature to respond to the unstructured data communications, it's such an impactful and yet less noticeable aspect of who we are as human beings. And so when I talk about narratives, it is those communications. And we may think that that's just kind of random and, oh, yeah, there's communications and maybe it makes an impact or maybe it doesn't. No, there are real rules to the game for what sort of communications are received by the human animal. You know, which sort of communications are more effective at triggering different brain chemicals. You know, I like to call it the dopamine economy. You know, what sort of messages and communications are more or less effective at triggering those brain chemicals. And all of this happens in a way that's mediated through technology, but all this happens in a way that you can measure, that you can visualize, and that you can then start to understand, both in a way to protect yourself and also a way to if not take advantage of what others are doing, at least understand how we as human animals are moved in small ways and large by narrative. So that's the research aspect of what I do. And, you know, I've been working on this for my adult life. This is my field in political science, you know, doing this stuff. Today, it's what we do at Epsilon Theory. The difference today is we have massive computing processing power at our fingertips to advance this research project in a way that was impossible 30 years ago. So I do two things. I do writing and I do research. I'm an inventor and I'm a writer. And the link between the two, what I write about and what I do research on, are these unstructured data messages and understanding the repeated patterns and ways of measuring those patterns in the way they affect the human animal.
So you talk a lot about narrative in your work, and you know, we mentioned it earlier that perhaps nobody has better mastered the power of narrative, which still baffles me today because he's a very poor storyteller, than Elon Musk. Talk to us a little bit about how you would analyze Elon and his strategy through the context of the narrative as you understand it.
Sure. Well, I'll give you a couple of different kind of aspects of this. What I mean by visualizing and measuring narrative is that it's now possible to create a data feed that goes into what I like to call the narrative machine. It's it's natural language processing, NLP, natural language processing. And it's possible to read or have a computer read, and I'm using air quotes, I'm saying read, everything that's published in the world, all of financial media, you know, and not just the media that's written down, but transcripts of everything this broadcaster said. It's possible in this world of big data to get all of that into a data feed. And because we have what I'll call a big compute, the ability to get essentially infinite computing processing power on demand from AWS or Azure or you know whoever whatever kind of cloud provider of computing processing you want to use, it's possible to, like I say, to apply unlimited computing processing power to this full set of the unstructured text and data, for example, that flows through financial media on a day-to-day basis. And the calculation that you make in natural language processing, it's not a complicated calculation. This is really not AI, right? It's really not machine learning. It's just brute force comparison of words and phrases and clauses in one bag of text, one article or transcript, to all the other words and phrases and grammatical clauses in, you know, hundreds or thousands of other bags of text. That's a factorial, though. So it's not a complicated calculation. It's just a comparison. But the numbers are staggering, right? So if you're going to compare all the words and phrases in one article, let's say it's got 1,000 what we call n-grams, 1,000 words or phrases, you know, units of meaning in that article, and you're going to compare it to 1,000 other articles also, you know, containing 1,000 n-grams each, that ends up being more than 500,000,000,000,000 calculations, right? And that's a pretty small data set. You just 1,000 articles with 1,000 n-grams each, 500,000,000,000,000 calculations. So it's not a complicated thing. It's a brute force computing processing power is what's required to make NLP work. And that's what we have today. And really have had at our fingertips for the last 3 or 4 years. So what you can do with this to bring it to your example of Elon and Tesla is that we can analyze every article, every television statement, everything that's made in the financial media world, everything that's said about Tesla, we can examine it for shared words and clauses, and then have the computer do what's called an unsupervised search, meaning we don't have to tell the computer, you know, oh, look for this or look for that. The computer says, no, we've got all these articles. They're using the same words and phrases, all the same word choices. We're going to cluster those together. And so the human can look at it and go, oh, that's what a narrative is. That's the shared language. And you can see these clusters of narratives. You can see them being born. You can see them grow. You can see them divide and multiply and ultimately see them die. What I would tell you, though, is that if you do this sort of visualization of the narratives around Tesla, the company, what you saw for years was and this is so unusual, you saw two very different and distinct centers of gravity with the narratives, with the articles, with the unstructured data that would be published or said about Tesla. One set of or one cluster, one center of gravity, would be about Tesla, the company. And these would be articles or stories that would share the language of production and profits and everything that you would, you know, talk about in a financial report. There's a whole nother center of gravity, a whole nother set cluster or supercluster of narratives that was all about ideas. You know, autonomous driving, batteries, you know, EVs, all of the stuff that was associated with Tesla, but was not about Tesla, the company. The way you interpret these sort of centers of gravity is, you know, which one is exerting more gravity at any kind of period of time? Because like I say, you can see these clusters move and shift over the overall graph or network over time. Whenever the supercluster, whenever the center of gravity about Tesla, the company, was more the center of gravity for the entire Tesla narrative, stock price goes down. And whenever the cluster or supercluster of stories, the center of gravity about, you know, EV and you know, autonomous driving and these kind of pie in the sky stories, whenever they were the center of gravity, stock price goes up. This went on for years. What you've seen recently, though, and this is why I say that Elon is himself, this is his great talent, is to, you know, to have this, and I think it's innate, this innate sense, this learned ability to recognize, huh, I need to be creating the stories around that latter center of gravity about the big ideas and, oh, it's space or solar power or, you know, EV or autonomous driving. That's what makes the stock work. And I've got an ability to move that along. So what you see, and this really started a couple of years ago, is that Elon, the articles talking about Elon's communications, right? The tweets, the Elon as a thing, those start to really form the center of this entire map of the narrative around Tesla. And since they tend to be more associated with those pie in the sky ideas, that Elon center of gravity starts to attract those stories to the middle. And that works for the stock. You know, look, occasionally he's his own worst enemy, I guess. And, you know, so he'll start talking about stock price or kind of the mission accomplished, $420, you know, and all like that. SEC comes after him to a limited degree. The SEC went after him and the stock price will go down. But in general, you know, Elon's real skill is in pulling those pie in the sky stories into the middle of the gravitational system around Tesla. And where you really saw this take off was over the past year, when the story became not even the pie in the sky stories, but the story became the Tesla stock price itself, right? Where the center of gravity was nothing to do with Tesla, the company, and frankly was even less the kind of big pie in the sky ideas. It was just the stock in itself. And when this happens, and you know, this has happened with Apple and it has happened in the past in history, when the center of gravity of narrative becomes the stock in itself, that's when the stock becomes completely separated from reality. Not just the quarterly production numbers and, you know, the real nuts and bolts of fundamentals of a corporate operations in the real world, but even becomes a little disconnected from the big ideas. And I think you've seen exactly that, and this whole battery day thing is a great example of that. What's required, you know, what battery day became was not so much, oh, it's going to be a focus on, you know, there's going to be some great announcement, which of course there wasn't. Right. The thing about battery day became, oh, it's a catalyst for the stock. And it's the same with the stock split. Oh, it's a catalyst for the stock. And what happens in these cases, and this is where it's going to be really interesting to see what Elon does next, is that you've got to keep creating the next story for the catalyst for the stock. And I'll ask you, TC, I don't know what that is. I don't know what the next story is. You know, because once these stories, once they happen, like the stock split, once it happens, then it's no longer a catalyst for the stock. So the stock goes down. Once battery day happens, it's no longer a catalyst for the stock. So the stock goes down. What's the next narrative catalyst for the stock itself? And if there is not a catalyst, then, you know, that then these narratives are like a shark. If they don't keep swimming, then they die. And so I think Elon and the Tesla, the stock lovers, are in for a pretty rough time unless Elon comes up with the next big catalyst narrative idea. You know, so I'd ask you, what do you think? Is what what's the next act here from Elon?
It's really hard to say. You know, I'm about five narratives ago, you know, we're all kind of tired and we sit around here in the office and we talk about it a lot and it's just hard to imagine. And battery day last night, we're recording this on Wednesday and we'll release it on Sunday. Battery day, I think, was a total flop and it was really spectacular. The promises made versus, you know, the old days and I see the stock is down today and who knows, but I can't imagine what the next narrative will be. Eventually, all of these manias end and, you know, they become sort of just as fast on the way down as they went on the way up.
Which begs the question, really, how is it that the, and how do you account for the fact that the narrative on Nikola changed so rapidly? You know, there's certainly been equally credible reports that have come out on Tesla across so many different areas as far as their treatment of employees, their accounting, their technology. You know, we've had whistleblower on Carl Hansen on this podcast, but others have done very detailed reports claiming far more egregious acts than what the Hindenburg report proclaimed about Nikola. And yet the narrative was swift in how it shifted on Nikola. What do you see in that?
Well, this is how, you know, I write a lot about this. So the game, you know, I talked about the game of markets and the way that there are rules to how narrative impacts us in a hardwired manner. And the technical name for this game of markets is called the common knowledge game. And, you know, listeners, you can do a quick Wikipedia, you know, search on common knowledge game. This is the game that John Maynard Keynes back in the 1930s called the newspaper beauty contest. And it's this core notion of how we rationally and logically respond to new information. So the way it applies here is that, you know, and I've listened to some of the podcast you've had, and I agree with the whistleblowing and the statements of fact regarding the Tesla narratives. But what I'd also say that from a common knowledge game perspective, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that you or I think that this is nuts, right? That these facts are being stated as are in fact true, right? It doesn't matter, and this is what, again, Keynes called the newspaper beauty contest, right? It doesn't matter, you know, whether we think these facts are true, that whether we think the picture of, you know, 20, you know, pretty girls in the newspaper, which is the thing they did in the 30s and what Keynes was talking about. It doesn't matter, you know, who we want to vote for as the prettiest girl or the prettiest stock. What matters isn't even what we think is the consensus view of what the prettiest girl or the prettiest stock or the worst stock is. What matters, and the way that common knowledge and the behavior of a crowd shifts, because that's what we're talking about. When we're talking about markets, we're talking about the behavior of crowds. What matters is, what does the crowd believe that the crowd believes? And that's a very different thing than talking about either what an individual member of the crowd believes. It's a very different thing from talking about what an individual member of the crowd thinks the crowd believes. Right? Those are respectively first order thinking, what you personally think is the truth, and second order thinking, what you personally think is the consensus or what the crowd believes. What drives markets is the third level of analysis. What does the crowd think that the crowd believes? And what the crowd will see as what the crowd believes, logically, rationally, is what information, what we call in game theory, a missionary, someone with a really giant media microphone, so large that they're able to tell the entire crowd some fact or some their opinion, you know, it's a viewpoint, right? So that the crowd believes that the entire crowd has heard that information. That's what common knowledge is, right? Common knowledge is not public knowledge. Common knowledge is information that everyone in the crowd believes that everyone in the crowd shares. And the only way for common knowledge to change is for a powerful missionary to come out and say, in this case about Elon or Tesla, this is a fraud. Right? And that's very difficult because Elon himself is such an enormous missionary. The investors and other, let's call it, interest of you know, powerful interest of money and politics that are equally invested in Tesla and Elon, they have enormous microphones. That wasn't the case with Nikola, right? I mean, it didn't take a big microphone, and once those Hindenburg notions were out there, right, they got publicized and published and printed and magnified in a way that, you know, your work, TC, it's never going to get magnified. And this is the frustrating part about the game of markets and the game of politics, is that you can be right and you can have all the evidence in the world that you're right, but unless you get that missionary as powerful as the missionaries who are creating the status quo narratives, common knowledge isn't going to change and the story doesn't break. So what you know, it can break a little bit. Like I'm saying, you know, right now where Tesla stock is, it's incumbent on Elon to keep on coming up with the next story about Tesla, the stock, the next catalyst. That's to, you know, keep it at these, you know, my view, insane levels. But to really break the story, you've got to get a powerful missionary come out and say, this is a fraud. And that's exactly what, you know, seemed to be happening, right? When, because the SEC is a really powerful missionary, if the SEC has come out and said, you know what, we're going to investigate this, we think this is fraud, if that comes out, right, that's the kind of missionary that is powerful enough to break the existing story. But unless you get that sort of powerful missionary to say something on a forum so that the entire crowd believes that the entire crowd has heard it, the story doesn't break in a big way. That's the at times disappointing, but I think that is the truth with a capital T about the way that markets work.
It's a fascinating analysis, and I would say that, you know, as much as I respect the work of Hindenburg Research, and I read the report just like you did, it's hard to imagine that Hindenburg alone is big enough as a missionary to take Nikola down. There had to be a lot of people in the marketplace of ideas willing to get behind that and push it forward. And I mean that with the utmost respect for Nate and the work that he does at Hindenburg. But it seemed like the entire market was ready to get rid of the false prophet Trevor and protect Elon, who is the one and only true God in this space.
Well, TC, you saw this as well, right? So you did a podcast with Trevor, right? And you were just you were slammed for just talking to the guy, right? I mean, it's once you start thinking in terms of narrative and these stories that we read as being a real honest to God battlefield, right, where the stories are intentionally constructed, where the stories are magnified and it's why I always try to ask, and this is, I think, the key to critical reading, to maintaining that critical distance between what we think is happening in the world of politics or the world of markets, is to always ask, why am I reading this now? Why am I reading this now? And just asking that basic question, it doesn't mean being, to dismiss it. It just means taking that step back and thinking about the way in which the presence of a story is itself part of an effort. Right, and just asking that simple question, I think, can make all the difference in maintaining our own, you know, autonomy from the crowd. I'm not saying, you know, don't fight the Fed, right? I'm not saying, you know, go out and short Tesla. What I'm saying is these are the things you have to be paying attention to. And the real danger is to give your heart, not just your mind, but your heart, over to the narrative creators, because they're thinking of you as a means to an end, not an end in itself. And that's the way that always ends in tears.
Ben, the hour has really flown by, but we'd be remiss if we didn't take this opportunity to discuss some of your important work on COVID-19. We don't really want to get into the politics of COVID, although we certainly have strong feelings here about, you know, the leadership failures the country has suffered through this year. You write a lot about what you call the pack at the Epsilon Theory. And the pack is really about channeling one's passion into doing real things locally that can make tangible, positive change, with the idea being that if enough people do the same, you can have a disproportionate impact nationally and perhaps even globally. Talk to us a little bit about the work you've done to try and get PPE into the hands of small community hospitals. And is that still an ongoing effort? And how can our audience help?
Yeah, look, you know, we started this conversation talking about, again, these epistemic communities, about understanding that we're not alone. And the problem is just you know, how do we know who we are? how do we connect, and how do we know each other? And that's what I mean by a pack, right? I mean, you've got a pack, you know, Epsilon Theory is a pack. We all can find a pack, right? And by a pack, I mean people who don't think of each other as a means to an end, right? A political party is never a pack. Your company is never a pack. You know, it's your friends, it's your true friends, again, who treat you as an end in itself, not as a means to an end. And the power of the pack is enormous, not for doing something top down, right? Not for doing something at the level of a political party where they're not your friends, right? But for doing things from the bottom up. And that was our goal in starting what we call Frontline Heroes, which is an effort to both buy N95 and N95 equivalent masks, and then actually get them to the people who need them, right? Not to try to compete with the million mask orders and of, you know, federal and state emergency management authorities, but not to wait on them either. I mean, we have this trickle-down world. It's a trickle-down world of economics, and it's also a trickle-down world of PPE, where if you're a nurse in a clinic and, you know, Port Charles, you know, Louisiana, you're not getting N95 masks. And that was the need from the bottom up that we thought we could do something about. So we set up like this underground railroad of just individuals. It's not big corporations and it's not working through government. It's just people saying, enough, let's do something. And so we set up an underground railroad. We were able to source and purchase masks in small amounts, you know, 500 here, maybe 1,000 there from China or whoever else makes these masks. We get them tested for quality. And then, and this is the most important part, we get them into the hands of the people who actually need them. So to date, we've distributed about 150,000 masks in batches of 100 or 200 directly to doctors and nurses and EMTs and firemen and prison clinics and shelters. Places are on the front lines of helping people and needing to wear some armor to protect themselves. So if the way people can help, and we've distributed now to, I think, 48 states, at about 1,300 different clinics and hospitals and, you know, fire departments and, as I say, prisons and shelters all across the country. We've got on the Epsilon Theory site, and it's easy to find me. It's epsilontheory.com. It's at Epsilon Theory on Twitter. But we've got a link there called PPE Request. If you're a healthcare worker or a frontline worker and you need N95 masks, or you know someone who does, fill out the form, let us know, and we'll try to get them some help. We're still distributing about 3,000 masks a week. This is not going away. It's not the urgent issue in major metropolitan areas like it was in March and April, but it's absolutely an urgent issue because of the way that COVID-19 is now endemic in the United States. It's everywhere. And so it is those smaller towns and cities and rural clinics and healthcare workers who need our help. And we're prepared to get you that help. So check out the Epsilon Theory website, PPE requests, and let us know if you or someone you know needs some masks, because we're here to help.
Yeah, great stuff, Ben. And I can think of no better way to end the show. You know, as Georgia said, we didn't want to get into the politics of COVID-19 because Lord knows that's quite the rabbit hole. But nobody could be opposed to getting potentially life-saving PPE into the hands of our brave and heroic first responders. And I would encourage all of our listeners to follow Ben's instructions and to do a little bit to help if you can. Thanks so much, Ben, for coming on. It's been wonderful. And come back anytime.
Thanks for having me. Really a blast.
And scene.
After the rich meal is done, we can open a few fortune cookies for fun. Some have said Zen is the sound of one hand clapping. You ask me, what is Zen? I ask you, what is Zen? Every poem rhymes, at least to its author's soul. Well, you may ask, what is Zen? Ask it of your pillow and let the night answer. The crowd is never wrong, even when it turns against me, or when it thins, or when, person by person, it disappeared from whence it came.